Good morning and happy Father's Day, and a special welcome to the fathers who are here today. I'll show you my tie. My wife is probably trying to slide down in the pew right now as we speak. It's difficult in these pews. It lives in the back of my closet. It comes out once a year, and she can't complain about that. I received that from my kids when they were about this high, and the way I figure it, wide ties and printed ties are probably going to come back in, so I'm actually ahead of the curve, and Looney Tunes are never out of style, so I'm allowed to wear it one special day. So to you fathers, it's a special day because you have such a special place in your children's lives. Studies have shown that fathers have a unique role in their child's development. For example, children learn much more about risk-taking from their father's rough-and-tumble interactions than they ever do with their moms. Even more importantly, in their spiritual lives, kids take their cue from their father much more than their mother. As they learn about their heavenly father, and as Mark spoke about, it's a solemn responsibility that you've been entrusted with by God. So my prayer is with you, younger men who have kids of an age that they are looking up to you. Charles Kettering, a U.S. inventor and industrialist who made his mark in the early automotive business, said this, and though he spoke of boys, I think it also applies to daughters. Every father should remember one day his son will follow his example, not his advice. So today we celebrate with you, and we make it known that we are here to help and support you in bringing up your children whenever and wherever you need it. In our study together, we've been looking at this Hebrew concept I called Barak, blessing. And I appreciated that in the prayer this morning, you spoke about that our gift this morning would be seen as a blessing from us to God. We've seen that blessing originates with God, that it honors another with word, that in the best cases it involves meaningful touch, that it highly values a person, that it envisions a special future for the one being honored, and that it commits us, if we really want to be a blessing, to be actively involved in helping make it a reality. We saw that our words are backed with actions so that the person we bless is built up, knowing that we are behind and beside them to create this new state of a richer life, of a state in which they are affirmed and becoming more whole. There can't be a bigger challenge for fathers than that. One of the things that we see about blessings is they might involve material gains, but much more they're involved in intangibles. Intangibles like understanding and growth, wisdom and discernment, and contentment and peace. A person in hospice has little need of a large bank account. They have no interest in a Princess Margaret million-dollar cottage, but they crave interaction and good talks and a picture of a new home where the disease that is wasting their body has lost, and they will be whole and surrounded by friends. Such is the nature of blessing. God intended it for us from the beginning, and He is delighted to offer it to us as His children. And as His children, we need to share blessings with others. We know from psychologists that the kind of compliments it brings are vital for our emotional well-being. Unless we think that it's restricted to the Hebrews of the Old Testament, the equivalent word to Barak, anglicized to eulogio, and from which we get words like eulogy, occurs many times in the New Testament. For God's desire has not changed, and this is exactly what Jesus brought in his teaching. Today, however, we're going to look at the flip side of the coin. We're looking not at blessing, but cursing. And now the teenage boy's ears have perked up. Where blessing brings benevolent and building up thoughts, curses bring malevolent and tearing down thoughts. Curses involve hardship and suffering and are consequences and punishment and not dreams of something better. An aside, curses called down upon oneself or another are the root idea behind bad language. Cursing, as our elders might have called it, or swearing in more modern times, evokes disapproval and disdain, boiled down into single words that emit cruelty and antagonism. Or increasingly today, swear words have even lost that shock value and are no more than emphatic placeholders. All of this goes back to the original curse, the only recourse God had where his blessing had been rejected. I don't know that I've ever heard a sermon on curses, but I felt like to really understand blessing, we needed to look at this. You see, just as blessings, curses too originated with God at the very beginning of humanity. Genesis chapter 3, 11 through 14. And he said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree from which I commanded you not to eat?" The man said, "The woman you put here with me, she gave me some fruit from the tree and I ate it." Then the Lord God said to the woman, "What is this you have done?" The woman said, "The snake deceived me and I ate." So the Lord God said to the snake, "Because you have done this, cursed are you above all livestock and all wild animals. You will crawl on your belly and you will eat dust all the days of your life." So the first curse was given to the serpent because it allowed itself to become a tool of Satan. And of course, with curses, there are consequences. First for the woman, an increase in pain in childbearing and corruption of the bond between her and her husband such that he would rule over her. Likewise, the man is burdened with painful toil to earn his food. And even more devastating, he and his wife would die and return to the earth that they were made from. Sort of sad right now. But in all of this, notice one thing. Unlike the serpent, the curse falls on the earth. Even at this point, God is deflecting man's guilt off to another. In God's great grace, he's bypassing any curse of humankind and transferring it to the earth. And of course, that's not the end of the story. He's later going to do that to a much greater extent with his son. It was never God's intent to curse anyone or anything. But our rebellion put a distance between ourselves and God and in effect condemned all of his work to a ban of his blessings. If that's the state of the things in the garden, it follows that the outfall of this curse will haunt the pages of the Bible from that point on. Indeed it does, and that's what we're going to look at today. Just as there are types of blessings, there are types of curses. We've seen the first, curses that originate with God, curses that he has sheltered us from the full impact of. The second type of curse is one that humans make and invoke God to uphold. This is commonly taken with an oath. You will recall the hasty oath that Saul bound his men upon in battle. one that nearly resulted in his own son Jonathan forfeiting his life when he ate honey when he knew nothing of the oath. And similarly, the book of Numbers recounts the action of a priest in the case of a woman accused of adultery who denies the accusation. She was to drink from water that was a kind of a test. If she was lying, the oath that she had stated carried a curse that would cause, quote, her hip to fall away, a visual picture of her wasting away in punishment for her sin. And in the New Testament is perhaps the most distressing story of this kind. Mark's version of the story in chapter 14 reads like this. While Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by. When she saw Peter warming himself, she looked closely at him. "You also were with that Nazarene Jesus," she said. But he denied it. "I don't know or understand what you're talking about," he said, and went out into the entryway. When the servant girl saw him there, she said again to those standing around, "This fellow is one of them." Again, he denied it. After a little while, those standing near to Peter said, "Surely you're one of them, for you are a Galilean." He began to call down curses and swore to them, "I don't know this man you're talking about." Peter is at the lowest point of his life, and he calls upon God's vengeance against himself if he's lying. And I think in some ways, his curse was honored by God. Rather than just letting Peter die immediately for his insolence, God gave Peter a lifetime to wrestle with the enormity of whom he had denied. If tradition is true, and we heard about that earlier this morning, we know that he died for his faith. What a remarkable turnaround, as God knew his true heart, and once again, God gave him what he needed, not what he deserved. The third type of the curse comes from our passage that was read from Joshua. This is one in which one person curses another. And in Joshua chapter 24, we heard read, and I just want to pick up on the last part. When Balak, son of Zippor, the king of Moab, prepared to fight against Israel, he sent for Balaam, son of Beor, to put a curse on you. But I would not listen to Balaam, so he blessed you again and again, and I delivered you out of his hand. This is Joshua as he prepares to hand the torch to a new generation. Yahweh reminds his people what he had done for them. First, he rescued them from Egypt with great power. Then he protected them through the wilderness, and he gave them victory over their enemies, the Amorites. And finally, he turned what was intended as harm by a pagan king into blessing by a man not even of his own chosen people. If you have a Bible or a device, you can turn or scroll to Numbers chapter 22 and you can follow along. I'm just going to hit some of the high points of this story of Balaam. The news of Israel's defeat, that's Numbers 22. The news of Israel's defeat of the Amorites preceded them. And it's recorded that Moab was filled with dread. Their king Balak described the Israelites as covering all the land, and he turned to Balaam, who seemed to have a reputation for calling down divine blessing or cursing. Balak says, "I know that whomever you bless is blessed, and whoever you curse is cursed." Verse 6 of Numbers 22. So Balak's delegation goes to this prophet Balaam, and he agrees to inquire of the Lord. As he sometimes does, God does agree to speak with this charlatan. His message was clear. "Do not support Balak, as I have blessed these people." Verse 12. And so the message goes back to the king that Balaam will not come to effect the curse. So Balak sends a larger and more distinguished entourage the second time with promises of great reward. But Balaam stands his ground. He cites the fact that he had indeed spoken to the Lord, and no amount of silver or gold would pit him against the will of God. Perhaps he wasn't a complete charlatan after all. He was listening. Yet he must do something rebellious, as we are soon told that when he went, the Lord was angry with him. In honesty, this is a difficult passage to completely understand. But later, Balaam does acquiesce and give in to Balak. Perhaps God is aware that he will knuckle under and do Balak's bidding. Revelation also states that he put a stumbling block in front of the Israelites. So God was not happy with him. And the story that follows of Balaam's donkey, that is a well-loved Sunday school story, because the donkey shows more sense than the man. The donkey is sensitive enough to recognize the angel of God ready to kill Balaam. And when Balaam abuses the donkey, who refuses to proceed down the road, she speaks to him. And she speaks to him logically enough to say essentially, "Haven't I always protected you and done right by you?" At that point, God opens Balaam's eyes and he realizes the mortal danger he had been in. To his credit, after having been reproved by a Jenny, and fathers, a message for you, listen to your wives. This is not the first or the last time a man was set straight by his female companion. But Balaam repents of his sin. Again, God directs Balaam to go with the men, but only do what he tells him to do. And Balak is angry. He's angry about the delay. But Balaam is once again apparently only ready to follow God's direction. "Well, I have come to you now," Balaam replies, "but I can't say whatever I please. I must speak only what God puts in my mouth." Verse 38. So sacrifices are offered, and Balaam is taken up to a high mountain to look down on the Israelite camp. And Balak gets more than he bargained for. Numbers 23, verse 7. "Then Balaam spoke his message. Balak brought me from Aram, the king of Moab, from the eastern mountains. Come," he said, "curse Jacob for me. Come, denounce Israel. How can I curse those whom God has not cursed? How can I denounce those whom the Lord has not denounced?" And Balak is flabbergasted. Balak said to Balaam in verse 11, "What have you done to me? I brought you to curse my enemies, but you've done nothing but bless them." Undaunted in the face of Balaam's revelation from God, Balak wants a second opinion. "Well, if you see them from this other mountain, they won't be so formidable." But Balaam receives another message and replies in verse 20, "I have received a command to bless. He has blessed, and I cannot change it." And in verse 23, "There is no divination against Jacob, no evil omens against Israel. It will now be said of Jacob and of Israel, see what God has done." And there we have the core kernel of the story. This is all about God showing his sovereignty, establishing the fact that he had blessed Israel and nothing else was going to stand in the way. I think perhaps at this point, Balak might have needed the donkey to talk some sense in, but he forges on. He wants to negate God's blessing yet again. Verse 25, "Then Balak said to Balaam, neither curse them at all nor bless them at all." And yet again, Balaam, he takes Balaam to a new high place where God might accede to a curse against Israel. This guy just does not give up. But Balaam blesses Israel a third time. He finishes with this ominous threat, which includes Moab. Verse 9, second part. "May those who bless you be blessed, and those who curse you be cursed." And the story continues with Balaam declaring specifically about Moab that their foreheads would be crushed by God's people along with several other nations. Balak wanted a curse, but God had turned it completely around. The blessing he had previously given to Jacob's descendants was intact and reaffirmed. Because Moab was rebellious, and instead of establishing peaceable relations with Israel, Moab would be the recipients of God's curse and would be destroyed. Once again, God was overturning the wisdom of man and asserting his divine authority to direct history. So let's go forward in time. If God was going to curse Moab and bless Israel, what happens in New Testament times? You might be thinking that so far in all of these sermons talking about blessings, we've not talked about Jesus' blessings in the Sermon on the Mount. And you'd be right. That type of blessing is actually a different word, unrelated to Barak or eulogio. It might best be translated as fortunate. But Jesus does speak about oaths that are the source of swearing curses. In Matthew chapter 5, beginning in 33, he says, "Again, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'Do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you have made.' But I tell you, do not swear on oath at all, either by heaven, for it is God's throne, or by earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. All you need to say is simply yes or no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one." Jesus' take on calling down curses upon yourself to fulfill a vow? Don't do it. It only invites temptation of the liar of old who will use it against you. In Luke's somewhat parallel Sermon on the Plain, Jesus says, "But to you who are listening, I say, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you." And Paul reiterates in Romans chapter 12 as he calls us to what he calls true love. Bless those who persecute, bless and do not curse them. That is being like God, turning curses into blessings. Of course, there is still that old curse that's been hanging around us since Adam and Eve. I mentioned earlier that God deflected the curse onto the earth. But the earth could never repay the sin that had brought the curse any more than the law could push aside judgment. The curse had to be ended. I will speak about that more, Lord willing, next time. But for now, I just want you to see that in God's plan, curses have an end. Galatians 3 and 13, "Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. For it is written, 'Cursed is everyone who is hung on a pole,' just as we saw at the supper today." Jesus became the curse for us to end the hold that the law had upon us. His victory means that the original curse, too, has already been undone. It only waits for the end of days to be fully put behind us. Revelation chapter 22 says this, "No longer will there be any curse. The throne of God and of the Lamb will be in the city, and his servants will serve him." That's God's end game. There will be no curse because God took it upon himself. So where does that leave us? Curses are something that live in a fallen world. God himself was forced to curse the ground on account of our sin. But Revelation reminds us that that's not the final state of things. Creation itself is groaning to be released from this curse, Paul says in Romans chapter 8, just as we ourselves wait for that new creation. I'll conclude today with a few practical points. First of all, curses are something that should be reserved for God. The oaths that bind God to judge and exact the consequences of curses are not necessary. Christians are to be honest, open, and transparent, to let their yes be yes and their no be no. As for cursing and swearing language, it seems that in the 21st century we are inundated with it. Use the internet movie database, IMDb, to decide if movies are appropriate. They have a parent's guide with a language descriptor. And we as Christ followers are compelled to stay away from harmful and hurtful things, things that hurt others and even our own psyches. We need to be an example for good, even when fathers hit their thumbs accidentally with a hammer. Most importantly, if we are Christ's followers, we strive to be like God. We look to the lesson with Balaam and actively work to turn curses into blessings.